We're talking about Wisconsin cheese and dairy exports here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin exported $3.5 billion worth of agricultural products last year. It's a slight decrease year over year. Canada, China, and Mexico are our top markets. But what about the Middle East? A delegation from several Middle Eastern countries took part in an international buyer's mission recently. They struck deals with Wisconsin-based cheese and dairy companies. Do you make, process, or sell cheese? How would you like the state's ag agency to expand or develop markets? We're at 800-642-1234. Brad Paff is Secretary Designee for Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Secretary Paff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So these cheese buyers come from the Middle East in Wisconsin to basically develop these relationships and strike some deals. Was this event a success?
It sure was. And we hope to have events like this going forward. Without a doubt, we here in Wisconsin are blessed with an awful lot of food that we produce, including some of the highest quality cheese in the world. And people from around the world want the opportunity to participate and to purchase that.
So what type of deals were made here? Will Wisconsin cheese be going specifically to the Middle East?
Well, those relationships are being formed and being developed and being cemented. I do not have information this morning to share as far as specific sales, but I can tell you that what we do at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is we play the role of matchmaker. We reach out and work with various buyers from different countries around the world, and we try and match them with Wisconsin cheese makers. And this would be a private sale between a Wisconsin cheese maker to food buyers in different parts of the world. But this is a role that we have played at the state of Wisconsin for a number of years. And under the Evers administration, I, as the Secretary Designee, want to do even more of this.
Secretary Paff, how much of Wisconsin's cheese is exported?
We are one of the nation's leaders when it comes to exporting specialty cheese. We make a lot of cheese in this state, as all of us know. We're number one in the nation when it comes to overall cheese production. But the cheese that we make a lot of specialty cheeses for specific markets. While there are some states, particularly in the West, that make cheeses for commodities, we tend to find value added in our specialty cheese. So the Wisconsin cheese that we are largely exporting is more specialized and more value added. And it is our understanding that as a result of that, the family farmer who produces the milk from their cows can receive a higher price for that.
Is there a sense of what these Middle Eastern buyers might be looking for as they look at the range of cheeses that Wisconsin offers?
Well, that in particular is what they were so so happy with, is the range and the quality and the variety. A few months ago, I had the opportunity to speak with some journalists from the Great Britain, from the United Kingdom. And when I met with them, I said, we can make the kind of cheese that your consumers want. You do not have to purchase the cheese that we already have. We have artisan cheesemakers around this state that are willing to step forward and make the kind of cheese that consumers specifically in your nation seek. And we will continue to do that. We here in Wisconsin have an opportunity with our family farmers, with the high quality farming that we have, with the cheesemakers that we have, the University of Wisconsin Center for Dairy Research. We are constantly doing research and we're doing consumer tests in order to find out what today's consumer, not just here in the United States, but also around the world, are seeking to put on their dinner plate. And we are ready to make the product that consumers around the world seek. And we have shared that with the buyers that were here from the Middle East. I also had the opportunity to share that with some United Kingdom journalists a few months ago, and we tell that story wherever we go, we will make the product that you seek for your consumers.
We're talking cheese exports with Wisconsin's Ag Secretary Brad Pfaff as our guide. What questions do you have about Wisconsin's business relationships with other states and other countries? And farmers, what would you like to share with the Agriculture Secretary? Let's hear from you at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Secretary Pfaff, some of this comes down to securing lines of credit with these new markets and trading partners in the Middle East. How much can cheese producers lean on the Export-Import Bank, which provides export and trade-related finance, versus really looking inward to our state resources here in Wisconsin to get credit flowing and trade started?
Well, that is an excellent question, and we need all of the above. Many of our cheesemakers, in fact, the majority of our cheesemakers in our state that make specialty cheeses are smaller family-owned companies that rely upon personal family financing or financing from their local community bank. In order to take the next step forward or to start participating even more in an international market, there is credit protection and risk protection that they themselves need to make sure that they have and their local lender needs to have. That is why we need to make sure that we have those partnerships with the Export-Import Bank. But also, it's important that we continue to build relationships with lending institutions that have done international trade relationships in the past. And this is very important as we continue to go forward, because we here in the state of Wisconsin, as I said earlier, we grow more food than we can ever eat ourselves. We have to be able to find new markets for that product, may it be locally, domestically, or internationally. And internationally is a place that we're continuing to look, because of the fact that Wisconsin, and Wisconsin cheese in particular, is so well-known internationally.
Secretary, you were recently in Mexico touring farms and attending an expo. What were your takeaways from this trip?
Wisconsin dairy and Wisconsin agriculture, but specifically Wisconsin dairy, is extremely well-known in Mexico. It is known for the quality of the product, but also our farmers and the farmers' practices are so well known and want to be emulated. What I saw in central Mexico, quite frankly, was Wisconsin's agriculture dairy footprint all over that state in Mexico, from the dairy genetics to the feed that they're feeding their animals to the tractors that the farmers are driving are being made in Racine, Wisconsin. So much of Wisconsin's fingerprints and footprint when it comes to agriculture and dairy in central Mexico can be brought right back here to the Badger State.
We're talking about cheese and dairy exports with our state's Ag Secretary Brad Pfaff as our guide. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Farmers, what would you like to share with Secretary Pfaff? Are you feeling squeezed by low milk prices or tariffs? Have federal and state programs helped you out? Call in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in this conversation in just a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about ag economic issues and markets for exporting Wisconsin-made products. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin ginseng growers say it's good news that the U.S. will freeze tariffs and reopen new trade talks with China, but it's too soon to say what the impact on Wisconsin's economy will be. Meanwhile, the state's dairy industry is trying to establish new markets in the Middle East. Do you make, process, or sell cheese? How would you like the state's ag agency to expand or develop new markets? What questions do you have about Wisconsin's business relationships with other states and countries? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Brad Paff is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And Secretary Paff stays with us. A little more on Mexico. Secretary, do you think we can strengthen our trade relationship with Mexico for our dairy products? Where do you see openings?
Well, Mexico cannot feed itself when it comes to dairy products. The climate there is not as conducive as it is here in Wisconsin in order to produce the amount of milk that is required. Where we can continue to differentiate ourselves in a very competitive global environment is making the specialty cheese products. The Mexican consumer wants dairy, but they really like cheese on their food. And we have to be able to find our niche there. We also need to recognize the fact that the Mexican consumer is getting younger. And we need to be able to make sure that we do our consumer taste test for our dairy products that reach that the younger people in that nation. We need to make sure as well, and this is where the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is to make those contacts. There are food buyers, food brokers in every country. We want to make sure, as our department works with these food brokers, these food buyers, in order to put them in touch with our food processors, with our cheese makers, with our ice cream makers, our butter makers, whomever they may be. We want to put those food brokers, food buyers in touch with our companies. That is the role that I continue to play. I also want to continue to make sure that our manufacturers, our dairy and food process manufacturers, are continuing to work with our university for the Center for Dairy Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in order to make sure that we're doing the taste test, we're developing the products that the consumers seek.
Taste tests aside, the milk market has been saturated. Prices have been low. How does that impact the ability to make and sell cheese and keep the cheese market going?
Well, without a doubt, dairy farmers in particular, but all farmers, have just been hit with a triple whammy. Really difficult weather the last 6 months. We have a trade war, quite frankly, that we've got to get out of. And then we've had low prices for the last five years. So farmers have been really impacted. We have a lot of raw commodity that's on the market. And that raw commodity that's on the market needs to find a home someplace. And it either can find a home at a low-cost destination, or it's my hope to find a higher-value destination. And so what I am hoping to do is continue to work with our specialty cheesemakers in this state, and we have hundreds of them, to continue to try and find markets for specialty cheese and dairy products that create higher value. Because if we don't, all that raw milk, all that milk that's been produced is going to go for a commodity price. And a commodity price, quite frankly, is just a market-setting price. And that isn't going to make anybody a lot of money.
Talking with Secretary Brad Paff, Secretary Designee of Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Secretary, let's talk about the trade war for a moment and competing tariffs going on between the U.S. and China, really hurting Wisconsin farmers, as you mentioned, and specifically soybeans and ginseng. So what resources are there for farmers? What are you telling them as they take a hit as a result of these tariffs?
Well, we at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, the number one thing that we can do is continue to try and find markets for their products. The other thing that I continue to share with farmers around the state is that our partners at the U.S. Department of Agriculture is providing some financial assistance at this time in order to assist with these lost markets. But again, a lost market is a lost market. We need to get this market back. And in order to get this market back, we need to have conversations of where we're going when it comes to trade overall. Without a doubt, we needed to hold China accountable for what they've done when it comes to stealing our intellectual property as a nation. But that's intellectual property when it comes to technology. Our family farmers are being held responsible right now for that. I think there's quite a stretch between soybean growers and dairy farmers and internet and intellectual property that takes place in Silicon Valley. Our family farmers are being held accountable for what's happened as far as the theft of technology in Silicon Valley. I struggle with that because I see these family farmers every day, and I recognize the fact that, you know, their bottom line and their pocketbook is hurting right now. We got to get this fixed.
Well, let's look at the weather for a moment. We've seen a wetter spring than usual. A lot of farmers had to delay planting crops or couldn't get them in at all. Is your agency prepared to help farmers when the weather negatively influences the yields?
What our agency does when it comes to that is that, first of all, we are a clearinghouse to be able to provide information. We do not have financial resources in order to assist if a farmer does not cannot get a crop in the ground. Our partners at the U.S. Department of Agriculture provides that assistance. Now, what I do is that I continue to communicate regularly with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and their officials, both here in the state of Wisconsin as well as in Washington, D.C., so they know what's happening here in this given state. And they can recognize the fact that these national programs, how they can work specifically for a given region of the country. That is what I do, and I try and do that as effectively as I can. I think it's important to recognize, though, going back to the previous point, is that we need to be able to find markets for these products. These products have to find a home. If they don't find a home, they're going to stay on the market. They're going to drive down prices long term, and that isn't good for anybody.
Do you see these national USDA programs, are they working for Wisconsin farmers?
They're providing a short-term financial assistance, but they're not removing the product from the market. And as long as the product stays on the market price continues to stay low. You have to remove the product from the market. And while it's appreciated that the U.S. taxpayers, through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, is providing financial assistance to the family farmers would rather trade their product than receive financial aid. And right now, they're receiving aid rather than trade opportunities. We need to be able to find a market for these products. Governor Evers, in his budget that he just signed, he's investing in research for our products. He's investing in local markets, and he recognizes that domestic and international markets are the future. We have to be able to find markets for our products. That is what is so important. No farmer works hard every day toiling the field and milking the cows in order to not have a market for their product. They want that market. And I want to be able to work with them to give them that market.
Secretary Paff, one more thing I want to run by you. The state budget is investing $48 million to expand broadband in Wisconsin's rural communities. How might this impact farm operations?
Oh, this is so important. In fact, I'm so excited at the fact that this is a down payment on the people's budget. We have a budget now that invests in all regions of the state and not just in particular parts of the state, and invest in all people. But what would this $48 million in broadband do for rural Wisconsin? It'll continue to move us forward. It'll connect us and interconnect us, not just to our neighbors and those that live down the road, but it'll connect us to the world. Why is that important in agriculture? Agriculture is more and more reliant upon technology every single day, from having video cameras within our barns and cameras within our calving barns to making sure that we've got our tractors and our equipment that have GPS. Everything is dependent upon technology as we move forward, and I am so happy that there was an investment in broadband technology, as am I very excited that there was an investment in transportation. We need to move our products to the marketplace. In order to do that, we have to have roads and we have to have bridges.
Well, Secretary Paff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Brad Paff is Secretary Designee of Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Coming up, we'll look at multi-state litigation surrounding the pipelines of Canadian oil transport giant Enbridge. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about litigation with Enbridge. That's the Canadian oil transport company. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. Canada holds the world's third largest crude reserves, but years of delay in building new pipelines has led to a glut. And we're looking at litigation in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota, and what it means for the movement of crude from Alberta's oil sands. The Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that Enbridge does not need to carry additional insurance for a project in Dane County. Attorney David Galt says the ruling was the outcome of a poorly written law passed by the legislature in recent years.
It says that local governments can't, you know, impose additional insurance requirements if the pipeline operators carry general comprehensive liability insurance with sudden and accidental coverage, but it doesn't even set a dollar amount as to how much insurance is enough.
How are you feeling about the outcome of this case? We're at 800-642-1234. WPR reporter Danielle Kading is based at our bureau in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Thanks, Kate.
So what led to the case was Enbridge trying to get a permit to build this pump station in Dane County to expand the capacity of the line running from Superior to the Illinois border. What happens now with this pump station project?
Well, it's been operational, and it has been for years. The company finished construction on it after the first court ruling in Enbridge's favor back in 2016.
And so what did we learn about this most recent ruling on insurance?
Basically, they learned that the county's insurance requirements were unenforceable under the law because of a provision that lawmakers slipped into the 2015-2017 budget. And that essentially prevented them from requiring that special insurance that Dave Galt from Dane County was talking about. But the county kept it in there anyway, and Enbridge took them to court, and landowners brought their own case. And so they've been fighting it out in the courts until the ruling from the Supreme Court recently.
So why did the plaintiffs in this case want additional insurance?
They wanted additional insurance because Dane County feared that the insurance that Enbridge had wasn't enough. Plus, they saw what happened in Michigan with the Kalamazoo River spill, you know, that released around 843,000 gallons of oil.
That was 2010.
In 2010. And that cost the company more than $1 billion to clean up. And some of those cleanup costs were disputed by the company's insurer. So they had Enbridge pay a consultant, basically, to look at the company's insurance. And that consultant found that there was a time element exclusion, which means that Enbridge had to report any spills within a certain amount of time. So the idea was that this added insurance was an extra layer of protection in case their insurance wouldn't cover it.
So if, hypothetically, if a environmental disaster would occur, has Enbridge said whether it would cover the cost? What has the company said?
Yeah, Enbridge has always said that they would cover the cost of any spill, regardless of how much it cost and whether their insurance would cover it. But the company's opponents say that that kind of all depends on how financially stable Enbridge is. And their concern is that it might not be able to foot the bill in the future if we're transitioning away from fossil fuels, or as we're transitioning away from fossil fuels right now.
How has Enbridge reacted to this court ruling?
Enbridge is pretty pleased with the Supreme Court's decision. You know, they say it's critical as part of their infrastructure to provide reliable energy. But just how much oil they'll send through the line kind of depends on what's happening with another project, Line 3 in Minnesota.
And we're going to get to Line 3 in Minnesota in just a moment. But the attorney in Dane County, David Galt, said, you know, this ruling is the product of a poorly written law passed by the legislature. What did he mean by that?
Well, basically, he was referring to this provision that was slipped into the 9-9 motion back in the 2015-2017 budget. And as if you recall, it was a number of motions. I forget exactly how many, but they were all written at the last minute and slipped into the budget. And so they feel that it wasn't really thought out, that this was something that didn't, you know, have a public hearing or go and receive public input, that lawmakers basically, essentially, they feel that they crafted it just to benefit Enbridge at the last minute.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She's a reporter for WPR based in our Superior Bureau. Did you want to see special insurance in Dane County when it comes to pipeline expansion or other counties? Or are you on board with the ruling? The number to join is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Danny, what did the plaintiffs say as the result of this Supreme Court ruling? What was the response like?
Sorry, can you repeat that? I mean, do you mean Enbridge or do you mean the landowners in Dane County?
The landowners in Dane County. Mm-hmm.
So the landowners are disappointed in the decision. They say that this is the result of politics influencing the Supreme Court elections in the last several years, where they feel that thousands of dollars have been poured into these elections from special interest groups. And they feel that that's influencing the court's rulings or justices' rulings on the court. So essentially, they're saying that court justices are bought and paid for, in this particular case, by business special interests.
Well, as we look across the border to Minnesota, as you mentioned, regulators there will have to decide to look again at this environmental review of the Enbridge pipeline rather than ask for the Minnesota Supreme Court to get involved. What do we know about that litigation?
Well, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission said they won't ask the Minnesota Supreme Court to overrule a decision from Minnesota. Minnesota Court of Appeals last month. And I have to say straight out that I haven't been covering that as closely. Our informal partners, Minnesota Public Radio, has mm-hmm. been doing most of that. But environmental groups and tribes had brought this appeal earlier because they oppose the replacement of Line 3. And they disagree with the process, and they say that this new line would impact sensitive environmental and tribal areas.
And so this is Line 3, which is the replacement line that Enbridge is putting in, and it is the one that is connects with Superior. Is that right?
Right. It runs it runs from Canada through northern Minnesota to Enbridge's terminal in Superior.
And Wisconsin and Minnesota aren't the only states where Enbridge is locked up in litigation. And you wrote about a lawsuit involving a pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac. What do we know there?
Yeah, and that lawsuit was brought against Enbridge by the Michigan Attorney General, Dana Nessel. That happened on the same day the company received a favorable court ruling, the Supreme Court ruling in the Dane County case. You know, if anything is certain with all these cases, it's that lawyers are keeping very busy. But Michigan's AG is suing Enbridge to shut down Line 5's dual pipelines running under the Straits. And she'd threatened to do that earlier last month if Michigan's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and the company couldn't reach a decision. And they say that Enbridge walked away from negotiations, took legal action, and so they responded.
Let's take a call now. Rich joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Rich. Oh, Rich, are you there? Nope, doesn't sound like it. Danny, what kind of energy challenges does Enbridge say this will cause with the issue running under the Straits of Mackinac?
Enbridge says this is going to have a significant impact on the state's energy supply because Line 5, which carries crude oil and natural gas liquids, provides more than half the state's propane with no other alternatives that could work. And in response, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has formed an energy task force to take a look at the state's energy supply.
And the pipeline that is running under the Straits of Mackinac, this is on the lake bed. This is on the bed, on the Lake Superior bed. Is that right? An exposed pipeline?
It runs underneath the lake bed. I apologize. It's on the lake bed, and it is exposed because anchor strikes from a tugboat that was passing by actually dented the pipeline, which has been used as evidence by the Michigan administration that this is why they want this pipeline to be removed from the Great Lakes, because it's old for one, and it's exposed and under great threat of being hit by strikes like that.
And would an anchor strike, that is plausible then? I mean, that is an issue.
Yeah, because it did happen, and it caused more damage for American transmission companies' electric cables running, where they had a spill of around 800 gallons of mineral oil running through their lines. The strike caused superficial damage to Line 5, but Michigan's administration, you know, the attorney general and the governor say this is too great a risk to take, where we could see a strike that might damage that pipeline and send oil into the Great Lakes.
So what are the next steps in this particular case on Line 5?
Well, I guess we're going to see what happens in the courts. Enbridge says they're committed to building a tunnel to house a new pipeline that may cost upwards of $500 million and take 5 to 10 years to build. But Michigan's administration says they won't accept that.
They want to accept that. And it sounds as if Enbridge is really having to deal with a lot of aging pipeline issues. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I mean, the age of Line 5, that was commissioned and built in 1953. And their aging pipeline, Line 3, I think that was in the 1960s where that was built. So they've had to do a lot of maintenance on these lines to keep them operating safely. And people would like to see the threats that are related to the age of those pipelines removed, especially as it relates to impacting the Great Lakes.
We're talking about litigation involving Enbridge. WPR reporter Danielle Kading is our guide on the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribe Reservation. Residents there worry about the aging Enbridge pipeline, Line 5. Here's Tribal Council member Dylan Jennings.
What we're finding is as the river begins to kind of oxbow off right in this area where the pipe is getting dangerously close to the eroding shore.
Do you live in the area of an Enbridge pipeline? Are you concerned about the work being done on it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about litigation involving Enbridge here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Canadian Crude Transport Company wants to replace an aging pipeline called Line 5 that cuts through the Great Lakes. And we've been talking about how this pipeline carries about 540,000 barrels a day through the Mackinac Straits. And the latest lawsuit by Michigan's Attorney General seeks to shut down Line 5. Dylan Jennings is on the Tribal Council for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. He says shifting currents are raising concerns about Line 5.
Right in a place where we see increased flow of water, you know, we see increased debris flow when spring and other types of flooding events happen. We're just not convinced that that's a very good thing at all.
Bad River Reservation residents, what are you seeing when it comes to aging pipelines where you live? What worries you? What do you think the company and litigants need to know? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. WPR journalist Danielle Kading stays with us. Danny, let's look more specifically at the Bad River Reservation. And officials there say the pipeline on the reservation runs the risk of becoming exposed and they want it removed. What does that mean given the topography of that area?
Well, Jennings says Line 5 runs underneath the Bad River, and that over time, as the river has changed, there are these areas being formed called oxbows, and that the pipeline is getting too close to the eroding shore there. And it's a very wet area. It's prone to flooding. In fact, residents had to move out of the floodplain there back in the 60s because that's where Odana was located.
So what has been the response from Enbridge on that?
Well, Enbridge says the pipeline has been operating safely through the reservation since the 1950s. And the company said in a statement that the majority of the easements that they have within the reservation will last for decades yet until 2043. And that it hopes for a mutually beneficial resolution with the tribe.
What does mutually beneficial look like in the eyes of the tribe and Enbridge?
Well, I don't know what it looks like, for Enbridge, but I think for the tribe, they've stated over and over again that they want the pipeline out and off of the reservation. So I don't know what that looks like for Enbridge, but for the tribe, it looks like them removing Line 5 from their lands.
And the tribe hasn't renewed some lapsed easements with Enbridge. How does that factor into all of this back and forth?
The lapsed easements, well, they had some tracts of land where these easements expired. And I believe they had been in conversations before they expired. And I think that was in 2013. And so basically it means that, you know, if they don't have those easements, then technically there's no agreement between the tribe and Enbridge to operate and maintain the line in those areas. But Jennings has said that, you know, they would never do anything to prevent Enbridge from maintaining the line and having it operate safely through their reservation. They don't want to increase the threat of a spill on their lands. So the company has been maintaining the line as needed.
And the tribe brought in independent analysts and looking at the integrity of this line. What was the result of the outside analysis?
Well, I don't know what the analysts are saying because Jennings said they're not ready to say who or what was in the report that they're working on, except to say that they found this erosion that could expose the pipeline.
And erosion aside, there's been quite a bit of flooding in this part of the state in recent years. Is that having any known effect on this pipeline infrastructure?
Well, Bad River fears that flooding and debris could cause problems with the line. And if there have been problems, Enbridge hasn't said so.
Is legal action against Enbridge on the table by the tribe? Is the tribe looking toward any type of litigation?
Jennings says everything is on the table, but he wouldn't say one way or another whether the tribe is exploring or pursuing legal action. The Ashland Daily Press had a story that quoted their tribal chairman, Mike Wiggins, as saying that that was something that they were considering.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She's a reporter based in Superior, WPR News reporter at our Superior Bureau. We're looking at recent legal challenges against the Canadian oil transport company Enbridge. You can join in with your questions as we take apart all of these legal challenges in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Danny, you've been covering the work that Enbridge has been doing, the litigation, as we have watched it. Do you find that the company is able to get their work done in terms of building up their infrastructure, keeping these lines that are over 60 years old going, because the litigation seems to be coming just at a clip?
Well, Enbridge is a massive company with billions of dollars in profits. I don't think that this is really tasking their ability to do what needs to be done to maintain the integrity of their line. Now, at least they haven't said that the legal action is directing finances towards lawyers instead of pipeline safety and integrity. But, you know, it's, I think it just goes to show the changing times that we're in right now, where it's kind of approached critical mass in several states, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, where you see more concerns now over the environmental impacts of this line. And there's a lot of fear over the company's track record related to the 2010 Kalamazoo River spill. And the company has said that they've paid for those sins, you know, that they've made changes. They've invested billions of dollars in safety and integrity of their pipelines. So they feel that they can handle what comes at them with their pipelines.
What have we learned since the 2010 Kalamazoo River spill? Do you think that there were some big takeaways there?
I think, what have we learned from the 2010 Kalamazoo River spill? Well, I think people, the public has learned that accidents can happen. And if, you know, kind of Murphy's Law, anything that can happen will happen. And that people should be prepared. Companies should be prepared and take the appropriate steps to ensure the integrity and safety of the areas surrounding their pipelines. That local governments should be prepared in their emergency response and how to, you know, quickly address these situations, whether it's a spill or a fire, you know, that there are steps that can be taken to mitigate the risks involved with a high-risk industry.
What is next on your agenda as it comes to covering Enbridge? What are you watching for?
There's a lot of interesting stuff happening right now with Enbridge. You know, one of the things that I've been watching has been discussion surrounding reversal of one of Enbridge's pipeline called the Southern Lights Pipeline. And essentially, they're looking at reversing the flow of oil rather than sending it from Canada to, I believe, Illinois, and forgive me if I'm wrong, and sending it back to Canada. So they're looking at different ways to use their pipelines as they're seeing, I guess, was pushback on their projects, as they're seeing delays on their projects. They're working around and making long-term contracts with shippers to ensure financial security. And they are trying to get the word out about, you know, basically we're in a state right now where we're using oil, we're using fossil fuels. And if we're going to continue to use them, let's make sure we use them as safely as possible.
Danny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Kate.
WPR reporter Danielle Kading is based in Superior. We've been looking at the legal challenges facing Canadian pipeline transport company Enbridge. Coming up, we look at how the state budget signed by Governor Evers turned out. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.